We can begin. Harriet Freeman, Millie Sinclair, part two. If you remember last week, we looked a little bit at Millie Sinclair's quite interesting career and life, how some of the aspects of her life are reflected in the novels that she wrote, so particularly Harriet Freeman, obviously the one that we're studying, but also Mary Olivier. And I want today to delve a little bit further into how Millie Sinclair's interest in the new science of psychoanalysis is reflected in Harriet Freeman particularly. And that's obviously one of the things that makes her interesting from our point of view as a modernist writer. You know, that interest in psychoanalysis is a modernist trait. So there she is. Looking rather different from the last picture I showed you. This is it's obviously quite a posed picture. She's looking quite dreamy and intellectual there, isn't she? As I say, she was a member of the of various modernist circles at the time. So she knew a lot of the major figures that we've mentioned and which we'll continue to come across. And she was quite a major figure, I think, at the time. But one of the odd things that's happened since her peak, as it were, is that interest in her has tended to fade away a bit. So until very recently, in fact, she was very little known. There has been some more critical work very recently on Millie Sinclair, and so she's getting more established. Her reputation is being kind of restored in recent years. So what I'm going to do is say something about her as a pioneer of what we might call psychological realism, and show some examples of that in Harriet Freeman. And in order to do that, we want to look at some psychoanalytical elements in the novel. So the idea really is to think about how Millie Sinclair used that new knowledge of psychoanalysis that was pioneered by Freud and Jung in the early part of the 20th century, how she developed her interest in that, and how that is reflected in the novels that she wrote, particularly, of course, Harriet Freeman, the one that we're concerned with. So, psychological realism as an idea, then. If we think about realism, going back to 19th century conventions, then the whole point about realism, of course, is that it's supposed to reflect real life. So if you go back to kind of some of the classic 19th century realist novels, Dickens or Gaskell, people like that, then the idea is that they are going to reflect the lived lives of ordinary people. I mean, and sometimes not so ordinary people, but the whole point is that it's going to be believable. So that you read something like Mary Barton by Elizabeth Gaskell, and you can believe that these sorts of people existed and they had these sorts of experiences. You can buy into that, if you like. Psychological realism, then, builds on that idea, but is interested in reflecting the life of the mind in a realistic fashion. How do people's minds really work? And I think it's something that we all know instinctively, I think, that if you think about the way in which most narratives are constructed, most novels, most other kinds of narratives, then they don't actually reflect that accurately, the way in which people do things, the way in which people's minds work, because quite often they concentrate on other sorts of details in order to drive the narrative. So if you want a kind of neat progression of ideas and a neat structure to your narrative, then you're probably not going to delve too much into the messy detail of how people's minds actually operate. Psychological realism tries to reverse that. There is a bit of a history for the focus on a troubled mind in as a central focus for a novel, as opposed to a normal mind, whatever normal is. I saw a little slogan the other day with a child asking his mother, you know, what does normal mean, mummy? And she said, it's just a setting on a washing machine, darling. whatever normal is, you know, who knows? But there have been some novels which looked at this idea of the troubled mind previous to Mason Fair coming along. Robert Louis Stevenson, Jekyll and Hyde, we probably, even if we've not read this, we've probably seen a film or we know the story. You remember Dr. Jekyll develops some kind of potion in his laboratory, and when he drinks it, he turns into this raging monster, Mr. Hyde. And clearly, at one level, it's a kind of science fiction-y type story. And you know, you can see the you can see all kinds of stories which follow on from that. You know, things like the Incredible Hulk. You know, same story, really, isn't it? You can see it just as that, but I think under the surface of that, what Stevenson is doing is exploring that sort of duality of nature, that idea of the good and evil sides of somebody's nature, and how that is expressed in the one character. And I suppose you could go back to Dr. Frankenstein's creation of the monster in Mary Shelley's book, 60, 70 years before that, to get a similar kind of idea. The other one I wanted to draw attention to was Charlotte Perkins Gilman, The Yellow Wallpaper, a favourite amongst feminist critics, because it features a woman who's oppressed by her husband and is effectively locked up in her bedroom, where she gets obsessed by the wallpaper. And the novel is quite a disturbing journey through the mind of the central character. Interestingly, from our point of view, it's 1899, so that's very much in the kind of field of the modernist era. And arguably, it is a modernist text in that it deals almost exclusively with the thoughts of the central character rather than trying to explain from an external point of view, how that came to be. So there is some precedent for this kind of thing that Sinclair does in Harriet Freeman. There's some precedent for that in relatively recent literature when she comes to writing. And of course, because Freud and to some extent also Jung were publishing their things and were becoming known in the early part of the 20th century, certainly, a lot of radical writers, a lot of avant-garde writers, were very interested in these new ideas, and they get reflected in their work. I suppose the other thing to say, maybe, is that some of these writers were themselves not exactly stable characters. So, for example, T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland, which we'll come to later on in the module. The Wasteland was written during a period of convalescence after a kind of mental breakdown. And, of course, famously, Eliot had his wife sectioned and taken off to an institution, which is probably... The origin of these lines from The Wasteland, where the speaker, or whoever it is, the voice in that passage, is dramatising this notion of fear and anxiety that seems to haunt that particular poem. What did you notice that Eliot's second wife, Valerie, died the other day? It's extraordinary, really, isn't it? You think of Eliot writing these things Wasteland 1922, 90 years ago, and yet there's a living link with him. Well, there was a living link until last week. So it'd be interesting to see what happens to all the Eliot letters and things. She was involved, Valerie Eliot, in this monumental republication of collected editions of his letters and so on. A very jealous guardian of the Eliot estate, and she's no longer with us. The reason that she's lasted so long, of course, was that she was relatively young when she married Eliot. There was, I think, 38 years difference between their ages. She was his secretary. Digression about Eliot. So in the literary atmosphere at the time, you do get this emphasis on the idea of the mental states of characters, perhaps more so than has been the case previously. And you also get, and obviously leading where those ideas actually come from, is the appearance of Freud's work appearing for the first time in English in the early 1900s. So they get translated fairly early on, and they are very much part of the intellectual scene at the time, certainly as far as our modernists are concerned. So Leonard Woolf, for example, the husband of Virginia Woolf, in one of his publications, he reviews Freud's Psychopathology of Everyday Life in 1914. And I think in the war years and into the 1920s, you know, these ideas are becoming very central in the minds of lots of our modernist writers. None of them really go as far as May Sinclair does in immersing themselves in this whole new area of knowledge, psychoanalysis. What May Sinclair does is that she actually goes to work at one of the first clinics to be established in Brunswick Square in Bloomsbury in London. And because by this time she's become a relatively successful novelist, she's got some money, and she invests some of that money in developing this new clinic. So that clinic, the medico-psychological clinic, was the first in the country to do that kind of classic work that we imagine psychoanalysis consists of, you know, the talking cure, as it were, getting the patient to explore their innermost secrets through regression to childhood and those sorts of ideas. That's the first place to do that, and May Sinclair has, you know, literally a vested interest in it. So it's very significant, I think, that she develops that interest, and that comes out in several of her works, but I think most tellingly and most incisively in Harriet Freeman. So if we think about psychoanalysis as this new subject, the clinic that May Sinclair worked in and supported, it's mission statement, if you like, was to study human character, social and individual. So it was about the study of character, what somebody is like, and how that's reflected. So, which sounds, you know, incredibly general, doesn't it? Rather vague. But I suppose it illustrates the kind of scope that they are that they're interested in. When you come to the novel, if you think about Harriet Freeman, then it is actually a study of character, isn't it? If you like, going through her life in that detail that we get in Harriet Freeman is an attempt to explain why she is how she is. That would be the kind of, you know, a simplistic way of looking at it. So, in that sense, you can see that the work of the psychoanalytical clinic that she was involved in does directly feed into the way in which she approaches the novel. And Sinclair had a kind of educational mission there, that she wanted to spread the word about how useful these new techniques were. And I think that does get reflected, as I say, in the novels. So Mary Olivier and Harriet Freeman particularly are really useful from our point of view if we're thinking about what constitutes some of the main threads of modernist writing, that this new area of knowledge, this new area of experimentation, of interest, psychoanalysis, I think you can demonstrate it in various of the novels particularly that we'll look at. Mrs. Dalloway, Good Soldier, I think absolutely there. Harriet Freeman, perhaps more so than the others, in that it stems from a study of psychoanalysis. You know, I think the other, Virginia Woolf, Fallback Sword, you know, they knew something about this, but they were kind of more amateurs, if you like, compared to Mason Clare, who had studied this material to some depth, and so she knew what she was talking about. Okay, so I've talked in sort of fairly general terms about psychoanalysis and its place within this novel. Let's try and dig down a bit deeper and see exactly the kinds of things that we're talking about. Are we okay so far? Yeah, okay, you're with me. Right. So if we think about some aspects of psychoanalysis within Harriet Freeman, then the first obvious area to dwell upon, I think, is the idea of subjugation. In other words, the way in which the natural expression that somebody might have of their personality through their behaviour, through their actions, through their thoughts, is, for Harriet, not allowed. She's not allowed to develop an individual personality. And, you know, we mentioned, I think, last week, that even in old age, she is still defining herself as the daughter of Hilton Freeman. You know, she doesn't have her own identity. She's latched onto her father's identity. So her development of the normal interests, the normal kind of female passions that she might have, isn't allowed. Why isn't it allowed? Because she has to behave beautifully. Her parents instill in her, and that phrase resonates all the way through the novel, doesn't it? That she has to behave beautifully. What behaving beautifully seems to mean is that she has to submit to whatever it is they tell her to do. And that her first thought is always, you know, what would her mother and father think, what would they say about whatever course of action is proposed? And it's only very, very rarely that she challenges them, most spectacularly in deciding that she's going to go down the lane against their wishes. So, right from the start, we've got this idea of a damaged personality, somebody who is not going to be allowed to develop as an individual. She's subjugated to the desires of her parents. And the result of that is a lifetime of guilt and inhibition. At various points through the novel, she has this rather vague feeling of guilt, which she then dismisses because she doesn't have the emotional equipment to deal with it. And she's certainly inhibited because of her lack of ability to break away from the parental imposition. Freudian psychology would say this is a result of what he called the maternal embrace, you know, the kind of smothering by the mother of any possibility of individual development. And certainly there are some hints at that, aren't there? When her mother dies, for example, you know, there's that idea that she somehow would kind of replace her mother, that she would almost become her mother in her own thoughts. So there is some evidence for that in the novel. The other big idea, I think, is the idea of sublimation. And psychologically, and we'll define it in a minute, psychologically this is to do with the diversion of energy into something else. Diversion, and by energy, psychologically, you know, it's often to do with sexual energy, if you like. So if there's no outlet for that, you know, then you can divert it into something else. So in Mary Olivier, the other major novel by May Sinclair, Mary Olivier becomes a writer, and so she sublimates all of her energy into that. So she achieves some kind of status, some kind of identity through doing that, rather than through expressing herself in more normal ways. Harriet, however, there's no possibility of it. This is a quotation from Stonebridge, Psychoanalysis and Literature, very interesting article. Harriet exists in a morbid familial rapture, a sort of living death. Expressed in rather melodramatic terms, I suppose, but yes, I think I'd agree with that. That she, it's interesting that the novel is called The Life and Death of Harriet Freed, and we speculated last week that there's that idea of it echoing to some extent those 18th century novels. Actually, those 18th century novels never, or certainly not very often, would include death in the title. The fact that we've got death in the title of our novel foregrounds it clearly, and you know, almost elides those two concepts, the life and death. So there is an idea that she, you know, she is almost sort of dead from the start. She doesn't live in any kind of positive way. No prospect of an escape into the life of the mind, because the life of the mind is shut out from her. You know, she finds it difficult, doesn't she, to formulate ideas and to speculate about things. And there's a couple of episodes where she tries to do that and fails. So she can't sublimate her desires, her energies into anything else, because she's got to behave beautifully, and she can't possibly go against what her parents say. So sublimation is actually quite an important concept, I think, in the novel, and generally, I think, in any kind of psychoanalytical perspective. So this is the sort of, you know, a classic definition. Primitive libidinous impulses, you know, sort of sex impulses, are redirected into new, learnt, non-instinctive behaviours, with the idea that learnt behaviours are socially acceptable, whereas the instinctive impulses would not be. You know, so if, as a Victorian or Edwardian woman, you actually wanted to, you know, have sexual relations with a series of men in a very promiscuous way, then that wouldn't be a good idea socially. So what you do is you don't do that, and you divert all that energy into something which is socially acceptable, you know, like knitting or something like that. So that's the idea of sublimation. And you can see with Harriet Freed that she doesn't have that outlet. You know, and it's a very... If you do get the chance, it's really quite interesting to read Mary Olivier as a sort of counterpoint to Harriet Freed. In Mary Olivier, you've got the same kind of pressures on the central character, but she manages to escape the shackles of a sort of oppressive society by diverting all her energies into writing. Harriet can't do that, so. You know, she's left with, as was mentioned before, Stonebridge saying this living death. So sublimation, then, you know, classically that's what it's about. And of course, you know, in the Freudian view, you know, about sex, so that's, you know, that's his view. But more generally, in psychoanalytical discourse, any redirection of energy from what's unacceptable socially to what's acceptable. That's a quotation from Penguin Dictionary of Psychology, so must be true. So that would be the outlet, wouldn't it, for Harriet, and we can see that happening in Mary Olivier. That would be the outlet that she would find something to divert her energies into, you know, that she would do something else. And it might be something as obvious as getting married, having children, and becoming a homemaker and a mother and all that kind of stuff. But she isn't able to do that. So she struggles with new ideas, and she's constantly retreating to her childhood. And one of the significant aspects, I think, of Harriet Freed is that as she gets older, and we, you know, we keep on being reminded, don't we, of as she gets older, there's that that little repetitive motif in the novel where you get a line like several years past. And so as a reader, you're constantly being nudged into realising that, you know, this is not just a few days later or a few months later, this is years later, and Harriet is exactly the same as she was. She's older, but she's certainly no wiser, and she's still regressing to her childhood. And of course, at the end, we come full circle, and on her deathbed, she does, in effect, become a child again, with the echoes of the lines from the nursery rhyme we first encountered when she was in her cradle. There are moments where she tries to break free and you know, develop some kind of interest, but she never managed it. This is from it's page 43 in this older edition, chapter 4, and this is when her father is in his library. He's got all these impressive books, and she tries to sort of join in with all that. She says, his eyes smiled, loving her, but you could see it amused him too to think of them. By which he means Darwin, Spencer, Huxley, these kind of radical thinkers. It amused him too to think of them, all these reckless, courageous thinkers, coming back to share her secret. His thinking was just a dangerous game he played. She looked at her father with a kind of awe as he sat there reading his book, in danger and yet safe. She wanted to know what that fascination was. She took Herbert Spencer and tried to read him. She made a point of finishing every book she had begun, for her pride couldn't bear her being beaten. Her head grew hot and heavy. She read the same sentences over and over again. They had no meaning. She couldn't understand a single word of Herbert Spencer. It's a bit like your experience with Ulysses, isn't it? Yeah. She couldn't understand a single word of Herbert Spencer. He had beaten her. As she put the book back in the place, she said to herself, I mustn't. If I go on, if I get to the interesting part, I may lose my faith. And soon she made herself believe that that was really the reason why she'd given it up.
So she can't cope intellectually with these radical thinkers of the day,
but doesn't want to persevere because she thinks that might kind of upset the status quo. And so she just kind of retreats to where she was to start with. So she's never able to sublimate her desires, her longings, into something else. And when there's an intellectual challenge, she never actually rises to it. Herbert Spencer is not as well known as some of the other contemporaries that are mentioned there, like Darwin, but he was actually, you know, Darwin is known for that phrase, survival of the fittest, which is often confused, actually. It doesn't mean survival of people with the best abs, you know, it doesn't mean that fittest in that sense. It means fit for purpose, you know. So if you're a dinosaur and climate change means that all your habitat is destroyed, then you're not fit for purpose, are you? Herbert Spencer coined that phrase, survival of the fittest, which is often associated with Darwin. So some other little mentions of that kind of thing. This is also in that chapter. And this is where she goes to the dance at the Hancock's house. And obviously, you know, if you think about the kind of social mores of the time, then the point of going dancing, if you're a young woman, would be to find a partner, you know, potential husband. That's where you might meet somebody. This is what goes through Harriet's mind. She wasn't sure she liked dancing. There was something obscurely dangerous about it. She was afraid of being lifted off her feet and swung on and on away from her safe, happy life. So she was afraid of being lifted off her feet and swung away from her safe, happy life. Now, you know, I'm looking at a room here full of people who are mostly in their early 20s, you know. So, you know, I would have thought when you were in your mid to late teens, probably most of you were thinking that would be great to be swung away from, you know, the position that I'm in into something new and exciting and different. She doesn't want that. She thinks of her life as safe. I mean, safe is an interesting word to choose there, isn't it? That's what she's after, safety. So she doesn't want to be swung away from all that. She was stiff and abrupt with her partners, convinced that none of those men who liked Connie Hancock could like her, and anxious to show them that she didn't expect them to. She was afraid of what they were thinking. She was afraid of what they were thinking. You know, so this is very kind of repressed, isn't it? You know, this is not being open at all to any kind of new experience. And what did she do instead? She would slip away early, running down the garden to the gate at the bottom of the lane where her father waited for her. It's that lane again, isn't it? She loved the still coldness of the night under the elms and the strong, tight feel of her father's arms when she hung on it, leaning towards him, and his, "There we are," as he drew her closer. Running off into her father's arms. It's disturbing. I think the more you think about the relationship between the father and the daughter, it's not explicitly expressed here, but there are hints, aren't there, that this is more like a lover's relationship, isn't it? She's dismissing these callow young men at the Hancocks. She's rushing off to meet her father and leap into his arms, and the word love is used. She loved the still coldness of the night and the strong, tight feel of her father's arms. It becomes a bit sinister in the end. But of course, there's no possibility of any future in that kind of relationship. So, as Stonebridge says, you know, in a kind of very reductive comment, but one which is perhaps justified. This is a novel about waste. You have a life there, Harriet Freke, which doesn't make any kind of impact at all, really. And the impacts that it does make, those crucial points in her life where she could have made a difference to somebody else's life, when Robin proposes, Maggie's baby, for example, you know, she takes the wrong decision, doesn't she? So, this is waste of a life, really. So this idea of sublimation, interestingly, Sinclair actually wrote about it. And in a journal called The Medical Press and Circular,
which I highly recommend. It should be on everybody's bedside table. It's actually quite difficult to find this quotation, but I did manage to track it down. So, yeah, she wrote for this, obviously, this journal, which was aimed at medical professionals, Medical Press and Circular. And she wrote a series of articles called Clinical Lectures on Symbolism and Sublimation, where she's obviously exploring this new field of psychoanalysis and what it meant to her. And she makes some pretty bold statements here, and this one really struck me. All religion, all art, all literature, all science are sublimations in various stages of perfection. Civilization is one vast system of sublimation. Well, that's a pretty big claim, isn't it? You know, that's everything. Everything is about sublimation. The point she's making, I think, is that the interesting word that she used there is civilization. So if you're talking about the organized system of living, people living in groups, in towns and cities and so on, then rules of behavior come into play, and you can't just follow your own instincts. You are subject to checks and balances, rules and regulations, and if you break those rules and regulations, if you transgress, then there are punishments. You know, there are kind of formal punishments. You know, if you go out and murder somebody, then, you know, the weight of the law will come down upon you. If you transgress in more sort of kind of social terms, then other sorts of perhaps more subtle punishments will come your way, given to you by other people. But that little quotation, I think, illustrates how important she felt sublimation was. So when she comes a few years later to write Harriet Freeman, she's writing from a position of interest and knowledge, and she's writing about somebody for whom sublimation is not possible. The striving of the libido, her capital L, that is, the striving of the libido towards manifestation in higher and higher forms. So it's this kind of suppression of what you might think of as natural instinct, sexual instinct, into something which traditionally has been thought of as, you know, nobler, art, literature, science, etc. So it's a really interesting point of view that she's got, and clearly that's got a lot to say about Harriet Freeman. How was it received, the novel? Not as well as her more popular novels from her Edwardian phase, where she was writing about kind of domestic problems in marriages and so on, and was quite popular. And T.S. Eliot actually reviewed Harriet Freeman, and this is what he said about it. He felt that the material was the soul of man, well, you know, including women, I suppose, the soul of man under psychoanalysis. But he felt there's no possibility of tapping the atmosphere of unknown terror and mystery in which our life has passed and which psychoanalysis has not analysed. So he felt it perhaps didn't go far enough in trying to tap into that, into the unknown, if you like. And when we come to the wasteland, I mean, perhaps it's worth bearing that in mind, that you could almost see the wasteland as an attempt, amongst many other things, that it might be an attempt to tap into that unknown terror and mystery. So in other words, he seems to think that it's kind of too pat an explanation, that here you have Harriet Freeman and her waste of a life, and that's sort of explained by a standard psychoanalytical perspective on it. Okay. So, I just want to say a bit more then about symbols and images in the novel. Freudian analysis puts
great store on symbolic ideas. You know, Freud famously wrote his book, The Interpretation of Dreams, and ascribed all kinds of symbolic resonance to certain things that that people tend to dream about. So symbols and images are going to carry weight in this novel. And when we look at it, very often what it seems to be doing is giving a sort of visual manifestation of a psychic experience. There's no other way, really, of dealing with some of those motifs. So the blue egg, for example, the sewing kit, which is enclosed in this kind of rather strange blue marble egg with gold curlicues on it, if it was mentioned once, then we perhaps wouldn't pay much attention. But it repeats. It's a centerpiece of the household. It gets referred to over and over again. So it must have greater importance than it just being an item of domestic use, you know, just a sewing. There's no time to go, and we'll do this in the seminars, there's no time to go into great detail about this now, but if you think about eggs, then you're thinking about fertility, you're thinking about growth, you're thinking about birth. But this is a blue, which is normally associated with sort of coldness. It's got a hard exterior. It's hollow inside, which suggests then a lack of life. And what's contained within it are these very sharp implements, which signify danger, don't they? The campions, the red campions that are referred to several times. Red, usually the sign of danger, the sign of maybe sexual, heightened sexuality, blood, those sorts of things. And at significant moments, the campions appear. In fact, at significant moments where there might be some libidinous activity, you know, when Robin proposes, for example, is where the campions are. So the psychic experience, in other words, what's going on in the mind of central character Harriet Freed, is being enacted, if you like, by these symbolic elements outside. So you might contrast that with imagism, where instead of just trying to convey the image, in a station of the metro, the petals on the bough are just petals. You know, it's just trying to convey that image. The faces in the crowd sort of merge into the petals, and for one fleeting moment, they are the kind of same thing. It's the reverse of that, really, because in the images that recur in Harriet Freed, they carry with them these symbolic overtones, these symbolic connotations. So you've always got a kind of hidden meaning, if you like, or not so hidden meaning in some cases, for these visual motifs that crop up in the narrative. So all the time, I think, you're having to be active as a reader and think about, well, what are the connotations of these images? And this stems really from, as I say, the work by Freud, The Interpretation of Dreams, because he says there that what dreams are ways in which unconsciously we articulate our desires. So it's a kind of safe way, if you like, of enacting some of our perhaps deepest, darkest desires. So if that's the case, then the kind of symbols that are used, you can see how that might work in Sinclair's case. She's also interested in what Carl Jung said about psychic symbols, because she talked about that in those clinical lectures that I mentioned before. So she's absolutely committed to this idea of the symbolic life of things and how they work within somebody's mind. And clearly, you know, as readers of Harriet Freeman, we've got a duty to examine that, I think. But maybe just to finish, the other thing that is perhaps worth pointing out is that feminist critics generally have been fans of Maison Clare's work. But some of them point out, you know, that she's used here a central character who is so kind of deeply damaged, and you know, a Freudian analysis would make suggestions as to why that is. That you know, she it's very difficult to read it in any kind of positive way. As a feminist interpretation, you know, this is, I suppose you could read it as a chronicle of patriarchal society, but it's very difficult to, you know, to kind of see her as any kind of feminist figurehead. And so that's maybe one thing to have a think about when you're thinking in more general terms about how this novel works. If you go to such lengths as she seems to have done, to give you a portrait of a wasted life, can that have any kind of positive impact in terms of a feminist perspective on her work? Right, so thank you very much for your attention. Have a short break and we'll see you in 10 hours. If you've not signed up on the register, please do so.